Hello, everybody. Welcome back to a very late, very delayed No Killing Goblins. I'm Oshi, and I'm here with...
Dragonus, who no longer has the plague of any variety, I think.
We hope. it's been a long time. We're trying to catch up with things. I do apologize for being unreasonably late with all these episodes, but... I think at this point, there was just no choice for both of us.
Yeah, I mean, it's the holidays, which is also the time when people are likely to get the most sick, and we drew the short straw on that one pretty bad. But, you know, we are fresh into the new year and ready to start kicking ass, taking names, and talking about web serials.
Yeah. I guess we should start with what we've been doing for the last month, since I don't think we've recorded, but we haven't uploaded anything since November.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Although, honestly, between being sick, working, and then having family stuff, I've not had a whole lot of time to do a whole lot of stuff. At least not anything that wasn't sitting around in bed and reading.
I've just been in pain. In various amounts of pain for various reasons.
Oof.
I don't know. I did watch some TV, and that's about it. I think I got into Slow Horses, which is a show that is made by the BBC and distributed by Apple, and it's basically capers and spy. I got the book series to read at some point, but yeah, it's fun. It has Gary Oldman in it.
Yeah, and, you know, I was about to say that, like, I had watched something, and it was on Netflix, and it was good, and I was going to recommend it, but it wasn't good enough for me to remember it after about a week, so I guess it wasn't that good after all.
So it was a Netflix show.
Yeah, Netflix has really perfected this art of having these very bingeable shows that you watch, and they hit you, but, God, they just have no time to digest. It's just straight in and out.
Yeah, but that's the point. Netflix wants you to forget them because then you'll come back to them and you'll keep subscribing and all that, which, yeah, whatever.
I have also read a few books and web serials and all that other stuff lately, although honestly, the one that was actually the best and that I feel like I want to recommend the most is the one that I liked the least.
Which is?
Have you ever heard of a story called Epilogue?
Yes, I did. It's the one on Royal Roads, right?
Well, I wound up reading an Amazon version of it. I don't know if it's got Royal Road or not. It probably does. Because it did. I remember the person that recommended it to me mentioned that it had been a web serial. But there is a professionally edited version of it that's up on Amazon.
Let me tell you what I remember from the thing I saw. It was... by Etzoli or Etzoli or something like that, and it's all about these kids who disappeared to another world and then came back.
Yeah, it's called Epilogue because it is just literally the epilogue to their story. They traveled to another world, they spent 7 years there, they have, you know, toppled an empire and experienced all that life, and now they're immediately back where they left from in their teenage bodies, as if, you know, maybe only a couple hours has passed. And, well, four of them left and three of them came back.
And it was, if I recall correctly, kind of reasonably short.
I read it in like an afternoon, although I did wind up staying a little bit too late to read it. But yeah, it's entirely reasonable. It's like a couple bucks on Amazon. I recommend it. I personally found it to be a deeply unsatisfying story, but to the author's credit, they wanted it to be. So, you know, mileage can vary.
It was interesting because the writing was okay. Let's take it from the perspective of like the writing. I liked it. The prose was well done. It was very young adulty. None of the characters seemed like unreasonable or strange or any kind of.
They felt like real people. They just felt like real
Right.
people I would never want to associate with in my life. But like their motivations made sense. Their like perspectives worked. You could very much feel the pain and depression and the lack of support system from suddenly being yanked out of these lives that they've built and being dropped back into like the real world. Like it's really good and very well written. That's really all I can say without maybe going into spoiler warnings. But I think that sums it up. I mean, it's worth checking out. If you're here, then you're probably isekai type people. So,
But this is not isekai. This book is
okay, yeah,
not
yes,
have
it is absolutely an isekai. It.
No, you're let me finish what I'm my thought, please.
Okay, go on, go on.
What I mean by that isn't that it's isekai, the aftermath. Think like the uncle who came, like the recent anime that came out with the uncle who came back from the other world with all the magic stuff. That's what this is. It's exploring the aftermath, and it doesn't necessarily have lots of magic and swords and sorcery or anything like that. It's a character study in the real world with everyone having like complex relationships that are pre-existing, and you sort of go through the story and discover the consequences of their time there and what eventually the like leads to the ending that it does.
Fuck, what was I? Oh yeah. So yeah, and like it is definitely a like character study. It's a sad story. It's a good story. I just don't think maybe I was in the right place to read it, so now I'm just gonna spend the rest of my life not liking it. But you know what? That's life. It's really good. Check it out.
It is. It was just it does it is one of those stories that you need to be like in the mood for. And it is, as he said, deeply unsatisfying, but in a good way, in a very good way.
Yeah, it's like the thing where the author delivered what they wanted. It's just what they wanted was to punch me in the face.
Right. I mostly I haven't been like doing much reading lately, but I did pick up one book. Partly, okay, this is very shallow, but I picked it up partly because of the cover, and partly because I know the writer. Not know as in personally, I know of the writer, excuse me. It's called The Spare Man by Mary Robinette Cole, and it's essentially a murder mystery plot set on a space station, not a spaceship, traveling between Earth and Mars, or a luxury liner. And it uses all of the like tropes and tricks of every kind of Murder on the Orient Express kind of deal thing. But crosses it with noir stuff, and the protagonist happens to be someone who suffered a debilitating injury, and as all the bits and bobs that make a current fiction sort of role where it's it talk. If you're someone who isn't going to respond well to like pronoun and typography uses, it's almost near futurist in that, then you're not going to enjoy it. But if you don't care about all that stuff and just want to read a cool story about murder in a space station that gets figured out by somebody and their dog and their handsome husband, who's an investigator, go for it, because I enjoyed the crap out of that.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check it out.
You can tell I've definitely gone into old person territory, because now I'm just reading procedurals.
I mean, I grew up on, I guess they call it like the airport novel, because I just found Michael Crichton, and it turns out that Michael Crichton is great for ADHD reading. You can just knock those books right out, like an hour a pop.
I have a thing about current fiction that bugs me. It didn't bug me as so much until I started like, reading more web serials and being more hooked up into the community. There's something really disappointing about like pressed fiction, like publishing house fiction, and what there's like all these little divisions, and as I don't enjoy, oh, I'm not doing a very good job. Let me just start from the beginning. I'm not really having a fun time with the publishing industry right now. And I think everybody has their moments where they find like fiction exhausting. There is a thrust, and this is coming from someone who's super liberal, and yes, I am super liberal. I'm queer, I'm immigrant. I genuinely believe in AOC's messages, and if she was president, that would be great. But there is a press and a push to put writers of color and of specific women and groups at the top of the at the front of the gate, but it feels really, really performative. It's great for the actual writers themselves because they finally get a chance to like put their fiction in front of us, and there are some really great writers who are getting notices that they would never have before. But at the same time, I can tell how desperately performative it is for the publishers themselves, and it irks me.
Yeah,
And
I agree, and I'm definitely on the subject of it all, probably definitely a little bit further on the right end of things than you are, although not particularly that far. But I get the same feeling, and I mean we're both queer people, so maybe you'll get what I say when I say this, but I am just tired of representation that's just there to be there. I would really like my representation to be of actual quality and not just like somebody's banking that I'll buy something because I like dick.
I am 34 years old. I lived through Grace, Will and Grace, and Friends, and Seinfeld. I'm too old for like the token gay dude anymore. Please, for love of God, we have moved on. Now they're doing token pronouns and token ever like stop. I'm old.
Well,
Stop. Where I'm the just
the
stop.
token
God
pronoun
damn it.
thing gets rough because we're still at a point where we can't even get people to agree on correct language. So, like, trying to insert token characters, but you could record it and put it up next week, and it would feel dated and aged. It's
I know. It's not just that. So there's this really great a little while back book that came out where someone did a Vietnamese writer did a like adaptation of The Great Gatsby with like that was fiction based on a primary character being female, like what Gatsby being female. It was a really cool concept and a really great story, but the way it was marketed to me, oh, I wanted to strangle whoever like wrote all that press and stuff, and I would not have bought it just off of what they wrote. Like at this point, I'm fighting to get past all this to get to the good
that
books,
was
though.
part of what drove me away from a series I actually really love, which is the Locked Tomb Gideon the Ninth stuff, because everything I heard about it, people kept saying, oh yeah, it's hella gay, it's sword lesbians, it's this, that. It's like, well, okay, but like, if the most you can think of to tell me about it is that it has sword lesbians, I'm not sure what depth there's going to be there. Turns out it's an entire goddamn ocean that I've drowned in, and I would have appreciated if people told me it was going to be a fun swim, not that it was going to be a swim with the correct flag colors people assume that I want to read. I don't know. I just don't like feeling like I'm, what's the word I'm looking for here? I don't want to say exactly being pandered to, but that like the fact that I like dick means that I am so utterly incapable of wanting more. Simple? I don't know. There's something here, but I can't quite put it together with my brain right now.
I have an example. There's a writer that wrote, hold on, I'm trying to remember. N.K. Jemisin. So N.K. Jemisin writes fantasy novels and like really specific speculative fiction, and she has a very particular voice and stuff. And she's like, she feels to me like another writer like Ursula Le Guin, where she's writing her perspective, her feelings, her things, the story she wants to tell in the forms that she wants to tell, and she's using fiction, speculative fiction, she's using fantasy fiction to do what it does best. Take the reality, turn it into allegory, and make something interesting out of it. And it's not always going to be comfortable or appealing at all times. She's written, like, The Broken Kingdoms and a few other series. Some of them are amazing. Some of them aren't actually that great. They grate a little bit, but they're good, structurally good fiction stories, and I liked reading them because they made me think about things differently, and they provoked thought. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're, like, books I will come back to 100 million times. He wrote The Killing Moon, stuff like that. And she's writing a current series right now. I'm trying to remember the name of it, because of course I'm bad at it. It starts with The City We Became. And it's this novel series about the great cities. And it's all about, like, it anthropomorphizes New York City. It uses New York City and the effects of things like gentrification and all these other aspects. It's such a good, like, fun story for me, because I have so much personal connection to it. It's such a fun story to read about, and there's so many, like, aspects of it and little details that I love, but it won't necessarily appeal to everybody, and not everybody will get it. And it's just, it's such a cool story, but the way it's marketed, oh, somebody wrote another story about New York. Woohoo!
I mean, to be fair, people spend a disproportionate amount of time thinking about New York.
Yeah, it's just, there are, it's really imaginative, but there are aspects of it that won't appeal to everybody, and it won't necessarily be great for everybody. And it's a fun read for me, but the way it's marketed, the way it's pushed, she's a Hugo Award winner. She's black. She's got such a fresh voice. It's such a glorious fantasy. You should read it, because that's all the reasons. Not the fact that it's like a, not the fact that it's a fresh way of taking in a modern Western thing blended with, like, and opinions and ideas and source material that's not the common vernacular. It's not everything's the same. The myths that are used, she's literally writing new myths, and it's really cool to, like, read about and enjoy. But at the same time, I have to go through all of your bullshit marketing to get to that story.
Yeah, and the fresh voice thing one particularly irks me, because that, like, you say somebody has a fresh voice and a fresh perspective, that's, like, a real thing of, like, quantitative interest. But it gets so overused, it's become background noise.
And that's what I hate about it. That's why I'm really frustrated with the publishing houses, because these motherfuckers, okay, I shouldn't curse so much, but the reason to bring this back to web serials, the reason I get really frustrated with it is because web serial work is actually fresh. It could develop into something. There are writers that are, yes, they're using, like, based work that is funny or simple and very genre and niche-esque with, like, Beware of Chicken and things like that. But these are the writers that will become the N.K. Jemisin, or will start the series and become the N.K. Jemisin. Except their qualifications are not the kind of qualifications that publishing houses want to sell. It's not even that they can't sell, it's that they don't want to sell those books, because their brand is not that. And it's a little high thinking about this, and maybe nobody is interested in this, but it bugs me. It's not about politics. It's not about any of that stuff. It's the manipulative marketing tactics are just bad. They're just bad. Why are they so bad?
Ultimately, it creates a situation where it's self-defeating, and it makes it harder for these voices to actually reach out, even when they are being given an opportunity. Because it turns out being given an opportunity in less than good faith is not as useful.
Can you imagine them trying to package Pirate?
Well, no, because, like, how do you package a mystery wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a what the fuck?
Like, how do you do that's exactly why they refuse to, like, a lot. I once read something from Alona Andrews a long, long time ago about one of their series, the Edge series, And they were talking about why it wasn't as successful as their other series and why it was so hard. And they came down to literally the marketing departments of these companies didn't know how to sell the series, and that was what killed it. Like, when you hear something like that, you don't really absorb it or understand it. And it's like 2 decades later, and now I'm like, oh, it's not that they couldn't sell it, it's literally because they didn't understand it. And if they don't understand it, they're not going to sell it well. And if they can't sell it well, something will get destroyed in the process. There was this great series called The 20 Palaces that was so like dark and very like by Harry Connolly, and his books just did not sell, partly because they were really rough read, but also because they were really badly marketed. Sorry, I'm talking
Yeah,
over
no, I
you.
just had a great idea, though. I know exactly how publishers push Pirate ABBA. You push the mystery.
How?
Who is this mysterious person who has written all of these words?
Yeah,
But,
well.
like, that might require imagination, and if they had imagination, they'd be writers and not marketing executives.
Whatever.
That was probably
So
really
to
fucking
br
harsh, I'm sorry.
whatever. To bring this back to TOI, well, the talk about mysteries and things, we're supposed to be wrapping up volume 3 with the two people that we haven't talked about in all these series, two people that most people care about, or at least one person that most people care about and the other person most people love to hate, Ryoka and Eren.
Ryoka and Eren. I do like that this volume followed up more with like the potential that I got from volume 2, that like these two could interact well and be friends. Because I'll be honest, one thing that I've noticed in retrospect in volume 2 is they didn't really s actually spend that much time interacting. Ryoka leaves aggressively. Constantly. It's, her shtick. And she had that
It's why
delivery
she's a
down set.
runner.
But, like, with Eren getting relocated up to Selim and having to sort of make her way up there and being around Ryoka's home base for once, and actually, I just realized something. You can take Eren, you can drop her into an unfamiliar city with an unfamiliar people, and she will immediately have found her way into a nice cozy place to call home, and this is her home now, and now Ryoka's visiting her own goddamn house.
I guess we should start at where does Eren start off? I know where she ends up. Well,
Well, this
let's
remember
leave
this
Eren out. Where does
okay,
he?
so for Ryoka, it is
Where does Ryoka start off? I know where most of her story is because there aren't a lot of chapters about her. She's in the north. I don't remember if she like. Oh God, I'm trying to remember how this all happens, how this all plays out.
I will admit, I also have sort of spaced out about what Ryoka was doing because I think she was just out like doing deliveries and shit. It's not until she just sort of bumps into Eren in Selim, or no, she was coming up from down south, remember? So she gets to the inn, she finds out that Eren has been disappeared, and then goes looking for her,
Yeah, and she ends up
going up.
in. Oh, now I remember. Okay. Let's pull it back a little bit. I remember what happened now. So, Eren ends up disappearing because Torin abandons her in the snow. We all know that happens. And poor Leonette and Mercia get abandoned at the inn. So Eren ends up in Selim, and she just, I mean, she does what she does because she's never. I think that was the first time she was around humans. Like a gr more than a group of humans, more than a few humans. I mean, she met a few humans in Lescore when the adventure started coming, but that was the first time she got to see, I guess, a human
Yeah,
city.
like what human society looks like, which, when you get isekai'd, there's a real chance that your frame of reference is entirely wrong.
And she's not impressed. She walks around the city, punches a few people, picks up some friends. She meets a bearded man who's a guard. She nearly gets knifed in an alleyway by a little kid. Oh, not by a little kid, by a gang,
okay,
which
the little kid
beats
was
up.
definitely an accessory. He may
oh,
even
oh
have
God,
been a conspirator.
What was his name? I forget his name. I forget all their names. You know I'm going
to
forget all their
names.
I was
about to make a snarky comment about that, but then I realized that, like, it could be considered a spoiler. But it's Grev.
Grev.
Yeah.
It was Grev. Grev and...
And you will do well
and
to remember
she meets,
his name.
And she meets a Drake, his Drake sister, which is a whole concept that I want to talk about in a second, but... What was her name? It wasn't...
Oh, yeah, her name I have completely spaced on. Holy
oh,
shit. You
God.
Know what? This is what the internet is for. But no, I keep having this problem because there's Grev, there is his sister Jassy, and then that guard, Fuzzy Lip.
Fuzzy Lips. It was a bearded guy. It was Fuzzy Lips because he had a great mustache.
I think it's Wesley or something.
Wessel or something. Yeah, Wessel. In any case, she meets a bunch of different characters, including Octavia, which is hilarious.
Oh, God. So, I love the way that, like, just everything about Erin is just so goddamn hilarious.
She's just having fun. She just, the entire time in Volume 3 for that start... She has no idea anything bad's happening. She's just stumbling around town, making messes.
The fun is, I think, a little complicated, though, because so much of her plot... This is the first time she has spent a lot of time around, really, anyone outside of her inn. Even in Lascaux, she's kind of a homebody. But out here, she has to sort of get a real feel for what is going on in this world, and she realizes that at least in this area, this point in time, it's just empty and a little sad.
And she meets Agnes, the innkeeper, with the sick husband, and ends up essentially taking over her inn and setting up shop in Sillam, where she messes with Octavia to try to make food. And this is where Ryoka comes in, and we're going to go back to Ryoka for a second. So I figured out, I remembered now where Ryoka was. Remember she ran from Lescor up to Teriark's cave?
She was so worried about Erin, and she wanted to go find her. That's right. And then she goes through all that effort and all that drama, and yet another round of cryptic favor bartering with the dragon. And then she just realizes that she's goddamn hanging out in fucking Sellum. I think she might have been talking to Octavia at the time.
That was it. That was the scene. So she goes to a secret dragon. The dragon, by the way, is being harangued by Magnolia in her call about being an old fart.
Magnolia
and she,
had to
like,
hit
Ryoka
mute
gets...
when Ryoka just tore into his fucking ass.
And she's saying, and then Ryoka starts like pummeling him, and Magnolia's laughing at him. And I love that scene.
Oh,
so goddamn much.
I just had the most cursed thought that has ever passed through my brain.
Oh, you have to say it.
Okay,
out loud.
Did you know that the suffix of the year is ussy?
It's ussy?
The suffix of the year was ussy.
Oh my god, no.
Yeah, so let's
really?
Just say that I can keep this thought to myself, and we can,
Okay, moving on.
But this is, by the way, especially from the American Dialect Society.
So, Ryoka and Teriark make a deal, and Teriark gives her some stuff and convinces her to go. Like, she's like, I don't know where to make this delivery. You gotta help me out here. You can't just, like, send me off and I might die and you have no idea. And he's like, okay, fine. And she does it by forcing him to, like... She does it by being clever a little bit and a little bit audacious. Like, she threatens to throw the rule book at him and get him blackmailed from the Runner's Guild and all that stuff.
Yeah,
it was
just
fun.
Like the pure indignation of it. Meanwhile, Magnolia is just on the goddamn phone line trying to figure out where the mute button is so she can please kindly not be heard laughing.
No, I remember it was Terriark trying to find a way
Oh
to mute.
yeah.
Yeah. Because Magnolia didn't bother. She just laughed at it.
But no, everything about that just hits this perfect confluence of comedy and
And it progresses, and they make their deal, and then Terriark does a scrying spell, finds where Eren is, and then drops Ryoka in the middle of Octavia and Eren fighting over the material she's using, and she's sort of like melted through cauldrons while trying to make a wondrous fair.
yep, Aaron is
Her.
busy being a terror upon common decency and good taste.
And Octavia is busy trying to save herself money while making like hundreds of dollars of gold. I don't know what's funnier, Octavia, Eren being a menace, or Ryoka popping into out of the air and saying, "Have you tried peppers?" Or whatever the
There
fuck it was.
is no part of it that is funnier, but there is a glorious whole that's greater than the humor of its parts. The only way it could have been better would have been if Terriark had just anonymously sent a voicemail to Ryoka going, "No, she's doing it wrong. Use that."
I honestly think Pyre it would have been improved, but it's a really good, like, simple confluence, and it's those chapters are a necessary sort of tonic to the darker and more in-depth Goblin and Torin and Istelm
And the
chapters,
horn
right?
stuff, which that gets pretty,
Not
yeah, not
nice.
nice. And
Not
also,
nice.
though not nice, is just the living, I don't want to say the living conditions, but there's something missing that Eren can feel. And I love the way that her solution to this, it okay, I'm gonna say something, and I promise I do not mean this in any strange or like derogatory way. But in a good way, wow, all these people are just not having a great time. I know, I'm going to drag everyone I can find together, and we're just gonna put on a play. It's teenage girl shit in the best way, or gay guy
It's
shit.
music, it's music, man.
Music Man.
Have you never? Okay, I'm gonna be reductive here. You are not a theater gay, and I know that
I am an
today in this
absolute
very
goddamn
second.
theater gay. I'm just.
It's the music man. She music manned it. I'm gonna put on a show, and we're gonna solve. It's basically every movie that Girl Who Sang Over the Rainbow and little short guy dude who did the Japanese Andy Rooney
Oh, I
and
know what you're
Judy
talking
Garland.
about. Now, okay,
Andy
Andy
Rooney
Rooney
and
and
Judy
Judy
Garland.
Garland. I think that I saw that in like class at some point in high school, but it did not like stick with me. I apologize. I'm already quote a bad gay Oshi. This isn't news. Just add it to the list.
Okay, but the point being that she, I'm not very happy with the way Pirate framed the beginning of those chapters because it made it very flippant. I understood why they did it that way and that it developed really well and the ending was great, but I just, it fed into the, it was a little too light, if that makes
A
any
little.
sense. And it feeds into that whole Eren is annoying trope
Yeah,
thing.
and it does stretch personally my credulity a bit to think that, there is just such a lack of entertainment and things to do, and more stuff like that gets added in later on, but like in the moment, it definitely like breaks me out of the world building a little before just how good the moments are pulls me back in. And
It would make
the
it did make a little bit of sense if you thought about it for more than 2 seconds, because it is a border town, and border towns don't necessarily have the height of, art and science and
Yeah,
all
but
that shit.
people usually have throughout history some sort of just something to keep them sane, just little hobbies. Especially like it, I don't know, it.
It does. I agree with you. It does stretch a stretch credulity to say that there's no like nobody has basic instruments, nobody sings, there aren't like town fairs. There's nothing like that. It's just nobody has any moment of it.
Nothing to really break me out of it, just that, like, it came to my mind. The other thing I'll note about this, though, is this is, give or take, according to one of my friends who dropped the story, the rough point where he dropped it. Mostly because he's a very strange man, and his response came something along the lines of, I don't take it for granted that just because these people come from a place that's hypothetically the future, that the things they're introducing are inherently better or more useful. And for him, it was like kind of the plays thing, and I thought that was an interesting perspective, because this is very much a like modernist, the things that we bring back will have inherently more value type of story. And
I'm not so sure about that, because I know how it can come off that way, but this is Pirate Abbey we're talking about, and they do rebut it quite often. And one of the complaints that comes up a lot from those who critique it is that those Earth folks are always the more boring of the two when you're talking about in-world versus Earth folks. And the reasoning behind that is that what Earth folks bring is not seen. It's fascinating because
I agree it's more complicated than that, but like ultimately, yeah. I think the story does land on the side of like the culture and values and technology and ideas that the Earthers are bringing do have inherently like more value. I think it was that, and he was deeply annoyed by pirates' nominative determinism.
Yeah. In any case, I did enjoy the progression from, well, the music man, let's put on a show, everybody! And Erin uses her few skills to perfectly remember all the plays that she read and all those stories, and she writes them all out, and all the, and Shakespeare's, the iambic pentameter of it all, charms everybody, and she gets Mustache Man and Jossie. Wessel and Jossie to get together, and they become Romeo and Juliet, and the first actors are born, and they have a stage at the Hare, and the players of Selim are born, or Selim, or however the audiobook pronounces it, because I don't
know. I need to go back and recheck the audiobook, but I think it's Selim.
Okay. In any case, that all happens, and that becomes the crux of most of her story, Erin and Ryoka's story. Ryoka does have, like, a short interlude in the play part where Ryoka and Erin end up at Agnes's inn, and she's taken over, and some guy tries to swipe her ass.
Oh, God.
That was hilarious. Erin punched the daylights out of him. That
oh, yeah, they brought
hilarious.
Violence down upon them. Although my favorite part is still Gary realizing that, oh, wow, I actually throw a mean punch. Because she, like, dented some pretty heavy-duty armor just with a good, solid right hand.
So in between all this, the big thing that happens in Volume 3 that we both have been forgetting is Ryoka made a friend. And Ryoka's friend happens to be a fairy. And her name is Eveleth.
Yeah.
And Eveleth is a cursing.
Eveleth is a
saint. Tiny.
Anybody who can tolerate Ryoka and is already, like, probably deserving of at least a nomination and canonization. But the fact that Eveleth, this vile-mouthed, cursing, tiny little gremlin of a fairy, looked at Ryoka and said, wow, this bitch needs friendship way worse than I thought, and, like, puts all this effort into being her friend, like, this can only be an act of charity.
Okay, fine. On the other, more epic thought that came to my head, here is a fairy, a being that is essentially immortal and has lived for thousands upon thousands of years, has turned around and made friends with Ryoka. This has no significance at all. Can you hear the sarcasm in my voice?
Yeah, especially when Eveleth reveals that Eveleth has been, like, tooling around with Ryoka specifically for a while now. And I now find myself looking back through other scenes where she's interacted in fairies and wondering which one was Eveleth. Is it one she was talking to? Like, My theory that the
How?
fairies were playing a very deliberate, like, game when they saved her and Mercia continues to gain evidence.
I mean, yeah. There's so much that comes with being a being who can see the consequences of their action. Literally, they can see the consequences of their action to a limited degree. They mess with fate. And you have to imagine the choice that Iveleth makes is not some small one. Even a simple friendship can be something with a great deal of weight. And she also gets pissed off and snows in the Selim fucking Runners Guild.
Okay, to be
I
fair,
love that
they
part.
had it coming, and if I tried to say exactly what Perseus had coming, I would probably get demonetized.
Okay, let's move forward from that. But she makes friends, and she makes another friend too. And in this case, it's Garia. She finally take Ryoka finally takes an invitation and heads off to Garia's family farm, the Strongheart farm, where she meets Garia's parents, a green mage and a ex-pirate.
Garia's parents are the best.
I love that.
I love that they have that big, like, I don't even know how to describe it, but it just popped into my brain. Like, big permissive parent energy. Like, they're the, listen, if you want beer, one, don't go out and do underage drinking at other people's houses. I have craft beer here, and I can keep a better eye on you and your friends.
There was a lot of debate during the period, like when the about Garia and her parents and their relationship, especially because I think the characterization of Garia as somebody who is like hasn't learned much, doesn't know much, doesn't understand things, isn't able to read, and then you meet her parents who are, a former pirate and an educated mage of, like, how is she the way she is? With these parents who seem pretty chill and cool. Like, there was some disconnect there, and I think Pirate did their best to resolve it later on and try to fix the issues, but
It makes
it's
sense to me in
there.
the way that, all children are embarrassed by their parents at a certain point in life, no matter how awesome those parents actually are. And
I was thinking more
well,
along the lines of, like, she couldn't read.
I mean, she
Remember?
had a little trouble reading, but like I some people like honestly, I didn't really think of that as an education thing. I've always gotten the impression that she might be dyslexic or something from that. Like, that was the way that I interpreted that. She had, she's clearly had an education in it. She just struggles with the mechanical brain part of it. Words.
Mechanical brain part. Okay. In any case, that's what she and Garia learns from Ryoka, the basics of punching and fighting, and she gets a new special class which will come later. But in the time, she also gets something else from her other friend from Iveleth. Iveleth teaches her to listen to the wind, which, I mean, that becomes significant. Eventually, I mean, it's not like fairy people teaching humans magic ever doesn't have like consequences whatsoever. That never has consequences.
I mean, the deep magic of the Fae is clearly meant to be invoked lightly and with little care.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a fun way to hear magic.
But it's like great setup, slice of life stuff. We get to see some of these characters bounce off of each other and like ex I've never heard here because I hate the phrase filler. Filler is utterly inappropriate here because it's not here just to fill space, it's here to establish aesthetic and feeling and like help deepen the relationships and help us understand stuff so that it doesn't have to be like repeated too much later. And this section of chapters is great for that for both of them.
Yeah. Sorry, I just got a bunch of text messages from someone I didn't want to listen to. Anyway.
But eventually things have to get serious again, and that gets marked by the Horns of Hammerhead returning triumphant from Albez with a great number of
Sort
magical
of.
artifacts and a door.
Right, and what happens is it resolves a couple of issues. Eren has the horns. The horns owe Eren for all her help for with them, and they give it by giving her what becomes one of the most significant aspects of Eren's new inn, a magic door that lets you transport people back and forth. And we meet again Termin the Rider, Termin the Great One, Termin the God,
Termin, he
who
who is mighty.
trans he who is mighty, and he transports the door back, and the horns and Eren get to hang out at the inn. And Ryoka takes, who is super trusted by the horns, and especially by Ceria, packs up all of their like special stuff. Well, what am I saying? Special stuff. Packs up all their
All their loot, their goodies.
Their loot, their goodies, and is invited to Magnolia's mansion and takes a carriage ride with Renald all the way up.
Magnolia helps pull
And
some
a
strings.
well, let's not skip over that part, because that's kind of significant. Ryoka stops running from Magnolia and actually goes to talk to her for the first time. And this is after I think Eren has met her, right?
Yeah.
So Eren, so Ryoka, her whole thing is that she is so up her own ass that she actually thinks that every single piece of knowledge that she drops is going to completely alter the. She's basically the white person in the room, because everybody else is not going to give a shit. And Magnolia reminds her of the fact that just because you have new knowledge doesn't mean that the world that you're walking into is in incapable is filled with incapable incompetence.
Yeah.
Just because you have gunpowder doesn't mean somebody else doesn't have nuclear weapons. Just saying.
What is particularly interesting to me, though, is that Ryoka personally has a lot of the details rolling around in her brain that a lot of like the other Earthers might lack. And
I can understand that. Yeah, I agree. She is the Wikipedia of
She had
the
her
Earthers.
moment where she could have gotten a lot out of Magnolia for very little, but out of her paranoid fear, she waited too long, and now Magnolia has gotten a hold of a lot of Earthers with way less knowledge than her, and they have brought down the value of everyone's knowledge in Magnolia's mind, because now Magnolia just kind of thinks it's a bunch of its bullshit. And the only way for Ryoka to prove that it's not would be to start giving over the information that she really can't and shouldn't. She basically just sat there and did nothing and lost her huge opportunity because she was just so goddamn convinced that she was the only person here and that no other people were going to show up with knowledge and, like, tip the balance anyways. And she was being so short-sighted and paranoid that when she finally
Which
does
is
decide she wants to do it, she just can't anymore.
fair in that she doesn't have that much knowledge, and it is a fair perspective, and I don't want to take away from the fact that, yes, if you're lost, you have no idea how you got there, there are p paranoia could set in, and you could, and if you're somebody who gives a shit about where you are and you aren't like interested in your or self-interested to that high a degree, you're going to care about what you give away, because you might destabilize the people around you might hurt people. And that's a fair perspective, and it's important to remember that. It's also important to remember that she's 20 and thinks the world revolves around her.
Well, yeah, even more so than most other 20-year-olds, I think. But I do think that you continuously underplay just how important her knowledge could actually be.
I don't. I think her knowledge is very important. I think what she made a mistake with and what Erin demonstrates by giving things like Shakespearean plays away is that her idea about what knowledge is important, at what knowledge is influential, is very divorced from the reality of the situation. Magnolia is more tied into the reality of the situation. What makes our world powerful is the systems that build the technologies that we use, and they support them and they work because of those systems, and those systems developed around the tech. An electrical grid doesn't just poof into existence. It just doesn't. Even it's not going to change the world overnight, but a play, an idea, a dish. Magnolia understands the power of that soft ability, and that's where she could have found value, and she didn't, and I agree with you in that aspect.
Ryoka did, though, understand that value, because she wouldn't even give Magnolia cookie recipes, because she was convinced that Magnolia, with her existing power and influence, would use it to gain dominance in the market. Like, I think a great deal of it is just that she's very correct to be very afraid of Magnolia.
Whatever. In any case, I just don't want to dwell on it too much. Ryoka does what she does, Magnolia does what she does, and they play off each other fairly well, and then she leaves and goes to Invisrol to do some things that I think are much more important. So Ryoka ends up in Invisrol, and in the meantime, Erin ends up back in, she travels via gateway, via gate, and she ends up back in Liscor, right? And I think this next sequence of chapters where we get a sort of parallel to all the devastation that happens in Esthelm, I should take this back. When she gets back, she has to deal with the fact that Leonette has grown up. Mercia considers Leonette a parent, and that Zell is staying at the inn, and that the inn itself has grown a little bit without her presence.
Yeah, things changed greatly while she was gone.
Yeah, and more than that, she has to face the fact that she makes multiple mistakes. Let's be real. Erin gets some comeuppance, and thank God. She's very young, she doesn't know what the fuck she's doing, and she makes some really bad personnel decisions, and she makes some really bad, it's all personnel decisions. She makes some suppositions about how Leonette is and whether or not she's good, and Zell is not happy with it and confronts her about it, and I love him for that. I love that scene.
Yeah, it makes me think actually about a line from a recent-ish comic in Order of the Stick, where a new person to their party is talking to, the chaotic evil dipshit character, who has got a bunch of character development. And she has no idea that he's the chaotic evil dipshit because he's reined his shit in by the time that they meet. And she's talking about how great it is to be with this group of new people because ultimately they don't really know the old her, and it's her chance to be her new person, or to be her new self, to, you know, that person. And then that's kind of how I feel as it is with Leonette. Leonette has reinvented herself and come through this fire, and Zell only knows the new her. And that helps him see the value of her in a way that Erin is just blind to. Meanwhile, Erin is trusting, I've worked in too many restaurants, and I just have this fixed image of the barmaid she tried to hire in my head, and I can't stand them.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean. I've lived with those girls. Not literally, but I mean, I've worked with them. It's not even girls, it could be boys, it could be anything else. It's just there are certain people in the world that are really excited to do something, but they just want to make sure that whatever they do doesn't inconvenience them in any way.
Yeah, and some of that stuff just felt specific to me of the way in which restaurant and waiting work, and just be that environment is so goddamn toxic to the soul.
Right? And I love that Erin gets a little bit of a wake-up call to the fact that, no, you don't know how to run an inn, and you don't know, and everybody should not be trusted, and you do have and you can make quite a few mistakes if you're not careful. Beyond that, I also love her interaction with the other innkeepers in Selim who try to like, hey, look, Missy, you can't just, you know, fire people, hire people, and run a business without, you know, covering things with us first, because we know better. And then she reveals the fact that she's higher level than all of them.
And it's like, you know, you have a bunch of like-minded business people that want to collude together to ensure that businesses run to their profit and not to their detriment. And, you know, that's all certainly okay and fine and good. No way, Aaron's just higher level than them, and she's just going to tell them to shut the fuck up.
I do love the whole interplay that pays out in the background in all this, where Zell is sort of like hating on the Antinium so much, and the Antinium sort of come back in the form of Zern and Kilbukic, who are returning to the inn now that Aaron's here. And one of the first things Aaron does, and what ultimately draws Zell into like treating her as special, not necessarily, but
into her orbit.
That's true. That's the word I'm looking for. He sees her a little bit more really, because I think Zell's a little bit like Aaron in that he really gets drawn to personalities and to people who prove themselves to him. Leonette did that, and until Aaron takes the action that I'm going to talk about, she wasn't really there yet. I will stop here, and I'm gonna say let's just cut here, and we'll talk about what Aaron does and how Ryoko reacts and how it all comes together at the end of volume 3 in our next episode. So thanks for listening, everybody. See you soon. You've been listening to No Killing Goblins,
edited by Liquid Ender.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.